This evening I'd like to talk about the liberation of the heart. I sometimes have the sense that perhaps one of the most prevailing and yet mostly unspoken suspicions that people have about meditation is the fear that it's somehow going to render them emotionally neutral. As much as we're often rocked and shaken by the heavens and the hells of our emotional world, we might feel that we perhaps prefer those swings of emotional extremes than to rest in an emotional desert. In the early years of my practice in monasteries in Asia, I sometimes used to find myself observing the monks and the nuns with a kind of a mixed sense of appreciation. Certainly I appreciated and admired their collectedness and their composure, and sometimes seemed so strong and so mindful. But I would find myself sometimes sitting there wondering and speculating what they might feel when they looked at a beautiful painting or listened to a wonderful piece of music or saw the first steps of a child, or how their hearts might respond if they sat at the bedside of a dying friend or spoke with someone or listened to someone whose heart was broken. And in my more irreverent moments, I did used to wonder if they ever had a belly laugh or ever really had any fun. And although there was obviously much better things I was meant to be doing with my practice and my time, it's a kind of an ongoing reflection, an ongoing investigation to understand what mindfulness practice, what equanimity, what single-pointedness, what letting go, the place of all of those qualities we speak about in the practice, how they interweave and how they engage with the very real emotional lives that all of us do have. Now, if we reflect, I think we see that it often does seem to be emotion that brings color to our life. That without emotion, our life would probably look rather drab, rather gray. Yet it's not so difficult for us to see that our emotional world can be at times so delightful, and there can be equally times when it seems to take us into a kind of hell realm, when we're lost in the intensity of rage or loneliness or lust or greed or fear. We're often left feeling really quite powerless and helpless and too often shattered. Upandita, who's a rather ferocious Burmese teacher, has this line that I absolutely love, where he says, "Lust cracks the brain." And, you know, I don't think it's just lust. I think sometimes when we find ourselves really in the hold of some really powerful, difficult emotion, you know, like anger or anxiety or fear or greed, it's like having our brain cracked. Those storms of emotion sometimes leave us feeling as if there is no ground beneath us. And they can be overwhelming and also distort our capacity to really see what is true anywhere, outwardly or inwardly. And so I think herein lies our dilemma. Now, few of us hold the aspiration in our practice to become emotionally neutral or bland. And yet I think probably few of us wish to live in a way where we would find ourselves overpowered again and again by the intense waves of emotional chaos. So our question here is, what is the middle path? Clearly, our emotions have a huge potential to enliven us, to bring depth and vitality to our lives. But I think also on a deeper level, our emotions have that potentiality to truly connect us. Because we see within our emotional world, there is both a personal element and also a very universal element. It's not unusual for people to experience, when they sit and they engage in serious practice, to make contact with sometimes a lifetime's accumulation of emotion. And some of those emotions can feel to be very unique to us. They're part of our story, part of our history. Emotions of anxiety or loneliness or hurt. You know, I think it's also true to, not difficult for us to see that what we see in our hearts also has such a universal element. There's such a universality to the feelings of grief, of sadness, of joy, of fear, of tenderness or love. Or in many ways, those emotions are, in truth, I would say, our shared language. They kind of cross the boundaries of individual stories. They kind of cross the boundaries of individual histories, individual minds or hearts. But just as our emotions have the power to connect us, it also is true, I feel, that they can really isolate us. Now, when we're caught in the throes, for example, of hatred or of fear or of rage, the separation between self and other feels vast. You know, the distance between I and you feels so immense. And at times those moments when we really feel lost or locked within the throes of our emotional world, or feel imprisoned by surges of fear or loneliness or heartache, sometimes I think for many people they can be the loneliest moments in their lives. The times when they feel most apart and most disconnected from other people and from the world. Now, meditation has an approach to our emotional world which I think is kind of unfamiliar territory to many of us, because it's not about suppression. You know, meditation is not about suppressing emotion, but neither is meditation particularly concerned with a kind of cathartic approach to emotion. We hear the encouragement again and again in practice to, both outwardly and hopefully inwardly, to cultivate mindfulness, to cultivate a quality of inner poise and balance. Any of you who've practiced at all, it's probably come to your attention that you've never been given the instruction to start yelling and screaming on your cushion if something unpleasant arises, or, you know, if the person who sits beside you irritates you. You've probably never heard the instruction that it's, you know, just fine to lash out and knock them off their cushion, you know. Neither probably have you ever heard any instruction or encouragement to burst into song if you have some particularly delightful thought arising or if a feeling of warmth arises, well, why not just reach out and hug the person beside you? You know, they'd be sure to welcome it. Instead, much more the instruction that is given is to listen deeply, to receive unconditionally everything that appears, and also to allow everything to pass. Instead, what we hear is the instruction to be mindfully engaged and connected without feeling the need to be governed by every single feeling that arises. We are encouraged to learn how to let go and how to rest in a climate, an inner climate of stillness and calmness rather than the climate of extremes. So a good question is why? You know, why take that middle path? You know, what does it bring to our life? How does it enliven us? That's what I'd like to explore. Now, it's not, I think, difficult for us to see that emotion sometimes governs not only our inner life, but also the kinds of relationships we form with the world and with everyone and everything we meet on a moment-to-moment level. Our responses to the moment are most often formed simply by how we feel about it. You know, we like one thing, we dislike another. We're attracted by something. We're repulsed by something else. There are thoughts and people and events that please us. And there are so many others that displease us mightily. Now, much of this emotional response, which is the forerunner to our words, to our actions, to the kinds of relationships we form, much of this emotional response and at times emotional reactivity can be actually quite unconscious. It seems to be operating just beneath the level of our awareness. And yet it's so powerful in forming the kind of world we live in and experience. Someone or something makes us feel good, and our emotional response in it is almost automatic. We do our utmost to stay close to that thing or person, to keep them, to maintain them. Someone or something makes us feel bad, and our response again is almost automatic, to recoil, to flinch, to push away, to do our utmost to get rid of it. And if someone or something leaves us feeling indifferent, mostly we ignore it, or them, or we dismiss them. I think when we're not conscious of the life of our hearts, we find ourselves endlessly being pushed and pulled one way and another, towards and away from, by our emotions. And yet, at times, and this is actually a tense way to live. It's actually quite a tense way to live. And it's also a very fragile way to live. You know, we're up, we're down, we're high, we're low. You know, we're elated, we're depressed. It's actually not only tense, it's very fragile, as if our states of mind and states of emotion seem to be so ambush us, take us by surprise. And yet at times, despite this tension, we can see the ways in which we get sort of intoxicated by this roller coaster. That we're almost intoxicated by the swings and by the extremes. Now, one thing I would like to suggest is that I think it's probably fairly clear that unconsciousness and freedom do not happily coexist. I think we can take that as a given. It's probably also clear to us that the places where we are most unconscious in our life are the places we suffer most deeply. The places where we're most unmindful, most habitual, in our reactivity are often the places where we suffer most deeply. There are many times when we can feel to be kind of like a hapless and a helpless victim of our moods. Now, we don't always think that's bad news. You know, when we're really enthralled with something, really infatuated, or, you know, infatuated with a particular fantasy, or, you know, a particular feeling, or a particular success or delight, mostly those times when we are really infatuated or intoxicated. I mean, how would you feel if someone came along to you and said, you know, well, you might remember this is impermanent? We really want to hear that? Actually, no, you know, it's the very last thing we would want to hear. We're most acutely aware of the painfulness of those swings when we find ourselves gripped by the equally powerful surges of fear or resentment or rage or sadness, the emotions we find difficult. Because, well, I think it's maybe obvious, like we don't have that tendency to be infatuated or intoxicated doesn't really leave us a lot of choices. You know, we can't decide that we're only going to be intoxicated by the pleasant. You know, if the tendency towards intoxication is there, as much as we can be intoxicated by the emotions we consider delightful, we are in reality, and sadly, going to be equally intoxicated by the emotional surges that we find difficult. Now, conventionally, our response to afflictive or difficult emotions is to resist, is to try and subdue them, or to try and replace those difficult or afflictive emotions with ones that are more uplifting and pleasant. And sometimes we have temporary successes. You know, if we feel sad, you know, we can turn on a sitcom on the TV, you know, or, you know, if we feel kind of lonely, we can reach out and make a connection. If we feel, you know, dissatisfied, we can order a pizza, you know. And so sometimes we have temporary successes, you know. We manage to replace an afflictive emotion with one that we like better. But I think even when we have those temporary successes, there kind of lurks behind them this fear, this anxiety, that once more we could just fall into the abyss of painful emotions. Now the problem, the difficulty I would suggest, is not the emotion, it is the unconsciousness. If we are to understand what emotional wakefulness is, if we're to understand what the liberation of our heart is, then the very first step is to bring consciousness and mindfulness to all those places where we've been more unconscious and unmindful. Like all things, our heart is awakened by the attention that we bring to it. Left unattended, our emotional world often just kind of seethes beneath the surface of our consciousness, and then too often catching us by surprise. Mindfulness, or giving attention to our emotional world, is really an act of befriending our heart. With mindfulness, what we learn to do is to cultivate a protected, benevolent space of listening to our hearts, of being available to ourselves. And I think our willingness to open into that emotional world allows us to meet it with trust, with some openness, with acceptance, and sometimes with a great deal of healing. For many people, this is really a profound shift, because in our life we can know a whole lot about contracting and resisting. And we're not always so skillful at expanding and opening. In listening to our emotional world, part of that is really beginning to notice and beginning to understand and to be intimate with the whole process of contractedness. Now, you know, we might not be able to relate to that word, but I think we can relate to the experience of it. And one place, you know, for me, nature has always been a place that graphically kind of illustrates what contractedness can look like. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen a sea anemone just beneath the surface of the water, you know, quite happily so fluid, until something comes along that just irritates it and it goes like this. You know, or if you've ever seen, you know, a turtle kind of quite happily trudging along, you know, until something touches it that's perceived as threatening, and how the head goes in and the armor is presented. Or you've ever seen a porcupine or a hedgehog, you know, in the face of something threatening and that curling up and presenting the quills to the world. It's a reaction of fear. It's a reaction at times of resistance. Now, sometimes I would say this might be a wise response. Sometimes it's a habit. Sometimes it's a habit of pushing away, of resistance. Now, for us, lacking the shells or the quills to present to the world, we sometimes meet our difficult emotions in different ways. Sometimes we meet difficult emotions with a lot of stories, a lot of conclusions, a lot of associations. Sometimes we so desperately want to explain them. I feel like this because you did this, and I feel like this because this happened to me, and I feel like this and because this event arose, you know, as if our explanation is somehow going to alleviate the painfulness of the difficult emotion. Another way that we meet difficult emotions is to become relentlessly busy and agitated in trying to fix them or avoid them. Or we become armored. Now, mindfulness is always a little bit, the invitation of mindfulness is always to place it in the midst of that which is habitual. You know, the very nature, the very essence of mindfulness is that it dissolves habit. So we learn to bring mindfulness and we learn to explore what it means to expand and what it means to open in the very places that we contract. Now, it's not as if mindfulness as is some kind of magical device. You know, it's not like mindfulness is a new solution to fix or get rid of afflictive emotions. But we learn to open through our willingness to befriend the places we're most close, through our willingness to really investigate, to explore what contractedness actually is in our bodies, our minds, and our hearts. You know, it's where I live in England, it's a very rural county with a lot of small villages. And one of the events that happens every summer is there is this best kept village competition in Devon. Now, you might think that this is a nice friendly occupation or hobby where people go out and potter in their gardens. Not so. This is war. You know, it's like one village pitted against the other. And, you know, there's a lot of conflict that arises out of this competition. You see, if you happen to be a person who doesn't care that much about your garden, you're really in trouble. You know, you get all this peer pressure, you know. Get it together, you know, because if you win, you get this plaque to put on the village green, you know, best kept village of 1999, you know, it stays there forever and everybody feels so good about themselves because they beat other people. Anyway, the whole thing is about, it is a war on imperfection. Or it's a war on what is perceived as imperfection. You know, so every weed is pulled, every wilting leaf is stripped from the trees, you know, every path is swept, every curb is cleaned, you know. It's a bit of a scene. Anyway, it's all about getting rid of what is deemed to be imperfect. And I often feel like this is not just a kind of Devonian pursuit, that this is often a life pursuit that many people engage themselves in heroically. And I think what a relief it would be if people would just learn to love their weeds. You know, and what a relief it would be for us to learn to embrace imperfection and to explore what real qualities of heart are being asked of us to develop to be at peace with that which is imperfect. I think we learn in our life that resistance just doesn't work. Maybe we're slow learners, but I think we learn in our life that resistance doesn't work. That all it does is armor us and harden us and close us down. How do we know that? We feel it in our bodies, we feel it in our minds, we feel it in our hearts. It's a poem by Wendell Berry, part of a poem, where he says, "I go among the trees and sit still. All my stirring becomes quiet around me like circles on water. My tasks lie in their places where I left them asleep like cattle. Then what I am afraid of comes. I live for a while in its sight. What I fear in it leaves it, and the fear of it leaves me. It sings and I hear its song." The Buddha spoke about liberation or vimutti in a number of different ways. He spoke about liberation through wisdom, liberation through understanding emptiness. He also spoke about chaito vimutti, the liberation of the heart through love. And he spoke about pervading the world with an all-encompassing mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, and immeasurable, free from hostility and ill will. The Buddha spoke about embracing the world with a heart imbued with compassion, with a heart imbued with appreciative joy, and with a heart imbued with equanimity. And he called this the immeasurable liberation of the heart. My sense is that these qualities of loving kindness, of compassion, of appreciative joy and equanimity have much to teach us about awakening and liberating our own heart. They are qualities that bring not only a way of meeting all the things and the people in our world with openness and expansiveness, but those qualities teach us too how to be present within our own emotional world with the same expansiveness and freedom, free of ill will and hostility. We are so prone to compound suffering through our responses of contractedness. It keeps us stuck. In investigating our emotional life, I think perhaps one of the first things we see is how very dualistic we are prone to be about our emotions. There's the ones we call good, those we call bad, those we welcome, those we feel ashamed of, those we accept and those we deny. There are emotions we welcome and other emotions we fear. I feel like the first step in liberating our hearts is to liberate ourselves of these dualisms. And this in itself is a gesture of loving kindness, because loving kindness really is an unconditional welcome and receptivity that we extend to the whole of our emotional world. And loving kindness is a key to understanding what wholeness and healing really is. In loving kindness practice, we continually sow the seeds of intention. May I be well, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. May you be well, may you be happy, may you be peaceful. You notice we don't ever say, may I be peaceful after my aversion goes away, after my loneliness disappears, after my rage or heartache ends. Loving kindness is not a way of getting rid of one state and replacing it with another, but it is really about now, about how we can be present in the midst of sorrow, in the midst of rage, in the midst of sadness and heartache. How we can learn to receive the painful with kindness and with tenderness and sensitivity. In the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha says, learning to abide independent, not governed by anything, not separated, not disconnected, fully engaged, but not governed. We see that in all the moments when we forget about loving kindness, in all those moments when we get really lost in aversion or resistance or rage, we turn away and we are governed. We are governed by what we turn away from. You know, sometimes I've seen examples of it in retreats, you know, where a person comes on a retreat and, you know, maybe they have authority issues or something, you know, and they look at the schedule and they say, no way, no one's going to tell me what to do. I'm free, you know. So they sit when everybody walks and they walk when everybody sits. They say, look how free I am. Are you? Or is it just being governed by the reactivity? You know, we see in our world, you know, where people proclaim freedom by feeling it's the liberty to dump whatever they're feeling on the nearest person. You know, people say, oh, you know, well, I'm free, and I'm free to express my anger. Well, you know, there's no shortage of people in our world free to express their anger. You know, go out in the street any time, you know, someone's free, kick the car, you know, shout at somebody, dump on somebody. It's not freedom. It's being governed by our reactions with little freedom within it. What does it mean in those moments when we're turning away from something to come back, to not abandon it? To see if it's possible, really, to open in those all those moments that we find ourselves wanting to flee from. You know, when we flee from the difficult, you know, into fantasy, into chatter, into the comfort food of distraction. And really those are the moments when we're invited to look, is it possible to reclaim our hearts? Is it possible to heal the separation? To know that this is pain, this is sadness, this is rage, this is heartache. Sometimes we can let go of the word my. I think sometimes when we use the word my rage, I am anxious, it's kind of already a beginning of being lost and abandoning. And I think if we can come back and see that this is just suffering, then we can ask, what does it need? And it doesn't need resistance, and it doesn't need hostility and ill will. But suffering needs loving kindness. Needs tenderness and warmth. It's like a willingness to take our place in our own hearts and the potential of our hearts. We learn to bring compassion, the unconditional commitment to listen to sorrow, to receive and embrace sorrow. You know, we can be so hard, not just on others, but we can be so hard on ourselves with condemnation, with demand, with the insistence, that we should be other than we are. And sometimes, sadly, I see that people on spiritual paths can be so violent towards themselves. It's almost as if they found a whole new set of values and expectations by which to measure their worth. You know, instead of I needed to be a success in the world, now I should be more peaceful, you know, I should be more calm, I should be more loving, I should be more generous. And sometimes it's just not what is happening. Sometimes it's just not what is happening. And compassion is really no more than a trembling of the heart in the face of pain. Not my pain, not your pain, not worthy pain or unworthy pain, but just a trembling of the heart in the face of sorrow. Not to be judged or dismissed, but to be held in that warmth of compassion. You know, a compassionate heart is not one that never, ever feels anger or fear or sadness. That a compassionate heart might be unwilling to blame, to mistake the passing waves of events for what is true. I think as we practice, we discover in ourselves not only our angels, but sometimes also our demons that lay and lie unresolved in our hearts. Sometimes we discover the unshed tears, the knots of contractedness in our bodies. We discover the way our minds are sometimes essentially, it seems, disobedient with their times of storms and obsession. I think at times we see, as we practice, the kind of lengthy files and descriptions we have gathered about ourselves. You know, I'm sad, I'm a failure, I'm unlovable. Sometimes as we practice, we meet in our hearts the grief and the disappointment and sense of betrayal we can carry. And how many times are we really asked in our practice to find the compassion to hold all of this? How deeply can we really understand that the way through suffering really lies in our willingness to be intimate with it? Not to dwell, not to indulge, not to blame, not to obsess, but to find the steadfastness of heart that can soften around the painful. Now, appreciative joy also plays a part in liberating the heart. If we mistake liberation for perfection or self-improvement, there's actually not much room for appreciative joy. Because we would always be fixed on what is imperfect and what is flawed, what needs improving, all the things that need fixing. It's like that saying, if a pickpocket meets a saint in the marketplace, all he sees is his pockets. If we practice with an attitude of unworthiness or self-hatred, then it's likely that we are only going to see in ourselves that which is broken. Strangely, we need to remind ourselves very often about appreciative joy. You know, you sit maybe with a knee that aches, but can you touch all the places in your body that actually are well? You sit with an oft-repeated song or story running through your mind. Can you remember just about your capacity to listen? Not only to that song or story, but to the sound of the bird outside the window. We can feel so agitated and tell ourselves, you know, I'm always like this. This is ever present. Can you actually notice in your body the places of stillness, the places of groundedness? Can you notice the space between the thoughts? You know, sometimes we practice and we feel, oh, I'm just not getting anywhere. I'm not making any progress. Can we celebrate the perseverance and the steadfastness that brings us to continue to show up for our life? Can we learn to smile upon ourselves in our practice, in our life, to find the joy of the moment? Now, compassion and loving kindness and appreciative joy, they're not just the result of practice. They're not just rewards for having suffered enough. They are qualities of an awakening heart that liberate us from ill will and from contractedness. Sometimes they liberate us through their cultivation, from the aversion, the hostility that can be so deeply embedded in our attitude towards ourselves that it's like a familiar pair of shoes that comes with a small pebble embedded that we continue to rub against. I think if we reflect upon our emotions, we mostly will see that joy and bitterness, that compassion or resentment, that hatred and love are largely the outcome of the cultivation and guidance of emotion. And our place in practice is really to ask ourselves what it is that we are cultivating. What are we cultivating in our hearts? What are we cultivating in our lives? What are we cultivating in our minds? Because what we are cultivating will shape our world. What we are cultivating will form the kind of world that we live in. It's not always hard for us to see if we are cultivating unconsciously even ill will or resistance or aversion. The clues will be evident in our bodies, in our minds, in our hearts, the contractions that are so painful. If we are cultivating loving kindness and compassion and appreciative joy, the clues will also be evident in the sense of ease that we come to feel in our lives. Now, equanimity also plays a very central role in liberating our hearts. Now, many people misunderstand equanimity as being a kind of stoicism or endurance or even indifference. These are not equanimity. These are actually a more subtle form of resistance. Now, none of us likes the range of difficult and painful and challenging events that we meet inwardly and outwardly every day in our lives. We will meet irritation, we will meet dullness, we will meet heartache. But every time we flee, it is actually like taking a vote of no confidence in ourselves. Every time we flee, it's like telling ourselves that we don't have the calmness or the steadiness or the balance to be present in our life. And each time we tell ourselves this, our world actually becomes a little bit smaller. Fleeing is like building fences and hanging signs on those fences in our life that says, it's impossible. Keep out. We can't go there. And what the saddest thing is that we are building fences around our sense of possibility. And the more fences that we build is the degree to which we settle for just a little bit less than what is truly possible for us. Learning to cultivate equanimity doesn't demand that we go forth and meet our most ferocious dragons. It doesn't tell us to go out and embrace our most difficult person. The classroom of equanimity is in all the small moments in our life where we meet the unpleasant with aversion, where we meet the pleasant with craving or infatuation, and when we meet the neutral with fantasy or forgetfulness. That is the training ground of equanimity. Learning to be equally near all things. Learning to be equally close to all things, to find the willingness to forbear. We discover actually that we can let go of resistance. that we can let go of aversion. Now, the world is not necessarily changed by this. You know, the unpleasant is still unpleasant. The difficult is still difficult. The pleasant is still pleasant. But we are changed by our willingness to stay connected. We are changed by our willingness to discover what it means to be no longer governed by fear or by wanting. So we learn about liberating our hearts in that moment. We learn to reclaim our sense of capacity rather than living in a sense of incapacity. We learn to reclaim a sense of possibility rather than living with a sense of impossibility. We actually learn about empowerment rather than disempowerment. And that liberated heart is very alive, very fluid, but it rests in steadiness. Now, to end, I'd like to read you a poem which is actually only vaguely related to this talk, but I like it so much that I'm going to read it anyway. And it's not, please, a geographical or national insult. It's called Telling the Story. In America, what's real juggles with what isn't. A woman I know props fabulous tulips in her flower bed in snow. Streets aren't gold, but they could be. Once a traveler mailed letters in a trash can for a week. He thought they were going somewhere. Everything is going somewhere. I answered a telephone on a California street. Hello? It was possible. A voice said, "There is no scientific proof that God is a man." Thank you. I was standing there. Was this meant for me? It wasn't exactly the question I'd been asking, but it kept me busy a while, telling the story. Some start out with a big story that shrinks. Some stories accumulate power like a sky gathering clouds, quietly, quietly, till the story rains around you.